Welcome to the flyfisher.co.za podcasts. Well, episode 6 is upon us, and before I get into what we did this evening, I just wanted to apologize for any of the RS feeds that have been broken. Any of the iTunes links have been broken. South Africa finally has iTunes in the country, so you can create a user account and do whatever you have to. The guys that don't quite know how to do it, just log on to apple.com, download the iTunes software, and you can set your podcast to automatically update so that when you get back into the office in the morning, it's got the latest version of the podcasts. For those of you who do know how it works, I hope you're downloading them and sitting there. I'm getting quite a lot of hits on the first couple of podcasts. Herman Wirtz has got over 250 downloads. The rest of them are also coming along. Tom Lewin's got quite a few downloads as well. I really appreciate all the feedback I've been getting from the guys. Thank you so much. Well, I had a really great chat with Murray Petter. He enjoys tying super realistics as well as salmon flies. And we chatted about how he got into fly fishing and how he got into fly tying. I found it exceptionally interesting. I'd like to welcome Murray Petter to the podcast. How are you doing, Murray?
How's it, Mark? Thanks for having me.
Murray, you're a great fly tyer. A lot of people know you for it, and you've been published in our local magazines. I have a few questions that we start off with, like, how did you get into fly fishing?
I started fly fishing when I was about 12. My dad bought my first fly rod and reel and that. I remember it was bought from the fly fisherman in Durban, or in Pietermaritzburg, should I say. He started me fishing when I was about 5, but that wasn't fly fishing, and I think the fly fishing sort of seed was sown then. We used to do a lot of bass fishing in and around Zimbabwe, and we came to South Africa in 1980, and he started showing an interest in fly fishing and started going, got me involved in it, got my first outfit, and I remember it was Rainbow Trout Farm, I think was one of my first fly fishing trips when I was about 13. And from there, it's just, the bug's bitten, and I've loved it from then.
Now, fly tying is probably what we want to talk about this evening. Well, I know I want to talk about it. How did you get into the fly tying aspect of it? A lot of us do migrate there, but it's difficult for somebody starting out. It's a little bit expensive. So, I mean, you've been fishing for a long time. How did you get into the fly tying?
Well, it's interesting you say expensive. I started, my dad bought me a fly tying kit, a high flyers fly tying kit. It was 35 Rand. That was in 1982. Yeah, I just sort of, I was 13 odd, coming on 14. He bought me this kit, and I was obviously into my fly fishing, and I devoured the kit. I went through it in like, I don't know, a couple of weeks, used up all the materials. The book in there was terrible. But those first flies I tied were terrible, but I sort of self-taught in the beginning with the aid of the book. And what really transpired from there, and I was very fortunate, was I went to visit Rosettenstein's in town. It's quite a well-known tackle shop in the centre of Joburg, and my dad was a car salesman in Edenvale, and we would go there, and then he'd quickly shoot across with me every Saturday, just about, almost every Saturday, to see the shop and buy some gear. And I saw some flies there on a polystyrene board tied by Terry Ron. And you've seen it, the guys have seen it in my articles. I often mention Terry, and he had such an impact on me in my fly tying. And I wanted to know from Rod Cross and Leo who had tied these flies. And the one particular fly was a very basic sort of spun deer hair fly. And I just started, and I looked at it, and I thought, how do you do that? You know, it looked really different and interesting. So Rod gave me Terry Ruan's number, and my dad phoned him and said, look, I've got my young son here. He's keen as mustard, and he wants to, you know, get better in his tying. And do you by any chance have any advice or offer any lessons? Because in those days, there wasn't a lot out there. I mean, there was obviously the odd books. The fly fishermen in Pietermaritzburg were coming along with their catalogue, and you could get a mail order catalogue from them. But information and equipment was difficult to get your hands on. And after my dad called him, he happened to just start chatting to my dad about where we're from, etc. And My dad was with the RAR, the Rhodesian African Rifles, and he was with the KAR, the King's African Rifles, and spent a lot of time in Malawi. So straight away there was a sort of interest there, which suited me great, because he said, right, come along, we're going to teach your boy to tie flies, and you and I can go. He had this unbelievably big Rhodesian teak, I think it was bar, you know, and that he had built in his house, I think he was living not far from Rosebank on the other side. Anyway, every Saturday, just about for 6 months, 6 or 7 months, I would head across there with my dad after work, and after we'd been to the various shops we could find, and he would teach me a fly and say, right, you sit here and tie 3 or 4 of those. Your dad and I are going to go and chat, and they would go and sit and talk about the good old days and the Rhodesian African Rifles and the King's African Rifles, and I was in this Pandora's box of fly tying room. It was an unbelievable fly tying room. I mean, to this day I can see it. And I had 6 months of one-on-one tuition with a really phenomenal, great tyer. Terry Ruan did symposiums in New York. He's tied alongside Dave Whitlock. He's about 80 odd now, so he's getting on. I still keep in touch with him once a year. Maybe I talk to him on the phone. He doesn't have email. You know, he's old school. And he still sends me flyers occasionally, and he handwrites everything. He's still in letter form. He'll write a letter to me. And, sure. And he just was a great man. He had a huge impact on me. And what he did for me, I think he taught me so much in that 6 months that would have taken me years to have learned. And that, I think, was the big turning road for me, as young as I was in my time. Now, I saw all these things he had tied, these realistics and fancy patterns. All I wanted to do was tie those. And he said, no, you've got to do 10 or 20 of these. And a lot of traditional wet flies and real classic patterns that really test you as a fly tie. He kind of started me on the basics, but he built me up to these, but stayed away from realistic flies and fancy looking stuff, you know, and kept me on the traditional side of fly tying. And that, I think, is what impacted on my time for me. I think I learned so much in such a short space of time. And yeah, I'll always be grateful for that, for my dad in taking the initiative and for him actually taking me on.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, it's an interesting beginning. So where did you move from once you had started at the ripe young age of 13?
I ended up spending a lot of, as soon as I was able to, my part-time work. I mean, a lot of us in those days were either doing a waiter's job or maybe a till jockey at, no insult, but at Checkers or whatever. You know, those days, that's what we did as youngsters in school. I found my way into outdoor shops and fishing shops wherever I could. I worked at Outdoor Living in Invale for quite a few years with Bill Steele.
Sure.
He had a shop there called Outdoor Living. It wasn't just a fly shop, but it sold fly gear, obviously. And it was one of the few shops then that was actually dealing in fly fishing equipment. And then, you know, I learned a lot from Bill. I spent quite a bit of time tying with him, tying flies for him, actually, between the ages of about 14, 15 to about 17 for his book, The African Fly Fishing Handbook. A lot of old school stuff in there, but it taught me a lot. It was great fun doing it. And I also, from there, I worked for Emmy Stores for quite a while. That's where I actually got to know Rod Cross a lot better, who I'd met at Rosette and Steens, but got to know him quite a lot there. Who later on, when I'd moved on and I went on through various, well, not various, but I stuck with Emmy Stores, Outdoor Living, and various fishing shops, just working my way through. And then wherever I got the opportunity, I was fishing. On my weekends, I was fishing. I wasn't into then the computer games and all that sort of thing. Maybe that's why I do a bit of it, more of it now. But I was fishing, and it got to the age where I was about to sort of matriculate and leave school. I did a diploma after that. Actually, matriculated, went and did a diploma, and in computers, datacom, and then didn't enjoy the aspect of going into that full-time. So what I did from there was joined up with a company called Gone Fishing, Irvin Stevenson, and he was in Orange Grove, and I spent about 2 years with them. They had an awesome store. I mean, that shop were the first guys, I stand maybe to be corrected, but in my, as far as I know, they were one of the first anyway, who started to bring in quite a serious range of fly fishing equipment, just fly fishing and art lure, actually, into the Johannesburg, the Gauteng area. There was obviously still the fly fishermen in Pietermaritzburg and Durban and that, but gone fishing. So I spent a lot of time with them. And then I left there and I thought, you know what, maybe I should get back into my field, well, what I'd studied, computers, and had a very interesting interview with Graham Duxbury from Duxbury Modems, and he said to me, well, why are you getting back into data comms? Why are you leaving, you know, the fishing industry? And I said, you know, that's a good question. Why am I? And I actually, the interview died there and then. And he realized and I realized that I don't belong here. So I left that interview, which was my sister had lined up. And I went and I didn't have a job as such. And Mark Yelland put me in touch with a Zimbabwean who was looking for somebody to run a fly tying factory who he had just purchased in Malawi. He owned one in Zim, and was looking for somebody in Malawi to run the fly tying factory. And I said, well, that sounds interesting. I don't have a job. So Mark put me in touch with him, and I hooked up with him. Really nice people. They did the tourist thing with us, took us to Malawi, Alison and I, my fiancé then, and we did the really zhush part of Malawi. But we went to see the factory, and I liked it. It was a big factory, doing about 57,000 dozen a year, or over a seven-month period. Yeah, sounds a lot, you know. That factory in Malawi was actually just too big and not big enough. Or not small enough, if that makes sense. It sounds strange. You know, in a fly tying factory terms, you can either keep it small and make a living out of it, or you go huge. If you fall in that sort of middle area, it's strange to understand, but I learned in the 4 years I was in Malawi, I learned that we were zomba flies. It did start to make money, and it was a pretty successful little business, but it was just not big enough and just not small enough. And it fell into that area where, you know, we had 70 tires and 120 tires full time. The big factories have got 800-900 tires in the world scheme today. The small factories are 10. You know, and the guys who've got those smaller factories, we've got a couple of guys in the local scene, they'll tell you, you know, with 10 guys you can make a living, make some money. It's controllable, it's manageable, stocks are small, inventory smaller, everything works, you know, or you got to go huge. I just had a chat with somebody today. He turned down a very big overseas contract, a local fly tying factory, because he's not prepared to go to that level of size unless he can do it at that level. You know, 500 fly tires and this and that. It was a big thing.
Yes.
But he turned it down. You know, how do you train from 20 tires to 500? You don't. It's years of investment and so on. So what I did was I spent 4 years there. I loved it. I would do it again. It was great. And after leaving that factory, I used to supply zomba fishing flies in Malawi. I used to supply Rod Cross at Fly Fishing Adventures with flies on quite a big scale, actually. We started to supply all these flies. And Ellie and I, we got married, and you know, just before we went to Malawi and full-time. And we decided we wanted to come back to Joburg. We were thinking of starting a family, and Malawi wasn't the easiest place to do that. Malaria and the hospital and so on. Came to South Africa, and Rod Cross offered me a job at Fly Fishing Adventures and as a manager, and I took over from Derek Manson. He was there. He was going on to Farlows to work for Farlows in London, and he went on to become a full-time guide for about 5 or 6 years. So I took over there and enjoyed that, and I was there for 4 years, and that's where I met Rico, my current partner in our stores now. And Rico got involved in the rod building. I sort of handled the store, and he helped out there, of course, and managed the store on the retail side. And after being there for about 4 years, we started Fly Fishers Unlimited, and customers of ours actually helped us start this business from Fly Fishing Adventures. They approached us and said, hey guys, wouldn't you like to go on your own? Everybody would. So we did. We got out there and started on our own with the help of these three clients of ours. And after about 2 years, they thought, right, you're on your way, guys. They had their own businesses, and they realized it's a small pie. Yeah. You know, five guys involved. So we bought them out after 2 years. They were happy. They're still great friends and customers of ours. And then that's where we are now. Yeah, Fly Fishing Adventure, Fly Fishers Unlimited. And we've since taken on a second store, March last year, Laxton's. We took Laxton's over. That's been a year now. It'll be a year shortly. And we say double trouble sometimes, but that's going pretty well. And yeah, so that's kind of a very shortened, condensed version of where I went from my dad buying me that first fly rod and fly tying kit. I don't think he realized that this was going to be the be-all and end-all for me, and it has. It's pretty much I eat, breathe, and sleep after my family fly fishing.
Okay, so you got a good lesson in basics. So what do you recommend the guys start off with as basics?
Look, the guys, I mean, today getting into fly tying, it can be a bit of a bewildering world, but it needn't be. My advice is, and I mean, we offer it all the time, is you can actually do a lesson, a tying lesson, before you commit to anything. That's something, advice I give to guys on a regular basis. And quite a few chaps take us up on that, where they'll actually come here, sit down. They're interested. They've obviously got an interest. They see people tying their own flies. They've seen the books. They've seen the articles. So they have an interest in fly tying. And it's going to obviously add another whole dimension to the sport. So my advice often, if they're not sure whether they want to commit financially to investing in fly tying, and we can talk about that just now, but they can come and do a lesson and actually tie their first fly within the first hour, hour and a half. It's a basic introductory tying lesson. And if they feel, okay, this is for me, and some of them they surprise themselves. They get a little bit of instruction. You're hanging over their shoulder a bit, but you're coaching them through it. And 9 times out of 10, if the seed is sown there and he likes what he's done, then he'll commit to the investment. My advice to beginners is either do the sort of introductory lesson, see if it's for you, then invest in doing it and get instruction. Books are great, DVDs are great, one-on-one. That's what I did. That's how I got into it. And for me, it worked better than anything, that one-on-one sort of tuition. Mm. So, yeah, without going too much into the materials and equipment and that's needed, get the tuition before you even commit. Invest in some instruction. To cover your basic tying tools, obviously a vise is critical. Now, my advice to people is the vise has more functions than just holding the hook. Yes, holding the hook securely is important. Spend as much as you possibly can, and if it takes more time to save, buy the best vise you possibly can. That is going to be the critical part, because if you're at that stage where you're into your tying and you're really getting going with it now, you've got past the basics, the last thing you want is a vise that's going to be, hook's going to be slipping. You haven't got a rotary function where you can view the fly from all angles. So good vise, number one.
What do you find, or how do you see the basic fly pattern? I mean, if somebody, okay, let's take John Barr's Copper John.
Yeah.
It's got a few things that he says you have to put into it. Do you stick to that pattern when you tie a CJ?
No, I would say a Copper John, in essence, what makes it a Copper John is obviously the copper wire abdomen, and I would say the epoxy and flash over, maybe not even the flash, but the epoxy over the wing case. Other than that, in my mind, you could play around with all sorts of things. You could change the tail, you could change the legging that he's using. I mean, you could use a number of materials there. The flash under the epoxy and over the peacock curl, you could play around with materials there. So there's quite a few areas you could substitute. I think what makes a Copper John is the copper body and it's got a bead, obviously. I think that's part of it, yes. Let's not forget the bead on the front and the epoxy back.
Yeah.
Okay, those are all kind of elements that we all relate to the Copper John, and I think they're quite critical parts to that fly. But I think you can use those basic elements that he puts into the Copper John and change it. I mean, the Bayer tails you could substitute with a Marabou tail or Coq de Lion tail or whatever. The hackles used up front, you could use partridge, hen hackle, you could use something a little stiffer like a pheasant tail. There's a number of materials you can use, or leave them out altogether.
Mm-hmm.
The thorax, instead of peacock curl, you could use a dubbing or a brush or a combination of materials there. And so you can play around with it. And that's what I try to teach people, is that don't think, and it's not so easy for the beginner, but for the intermediate to advanced guy, it's much easier, where you can say, okay, well, I don't have that, or actually don't want to use that, I'm going to do this. And then you can do that. And I do that all the time. I mean, I hardly ever follow any more patterns by the book, you know, unless we're doing something for an order or something. I really don't. I substitute all the time. And more from a point of view that it's not because I don't have it, and believe you me, sometimes there is a time when it comes across that I don't have it, and I've got 27 years of materials, but more because I think, ugh, I want to change that. And that's the beauty of tying your own flies, is it gives you that advantage or ability to say, well, I don't like that, or I want to change that, or I want to tie that a lot smaller than I can buy it in the stores, or maybe instead of standard copper wire, I'm going to do it with hot yellow and hot, I mean, there's so many colors out there,
I found something interesting reading about the copper john in particular, and was the fly I chose to speak about, was the reason he ties it in that manner is for the profile and the extra weight. So it's designed to fish underneath a hopper in fast broken water. Good. And I think if we understand what a fly is designed to do, we can tie it in the style.
Yeah, very good point. I think you hit it on the nail there. That's very true. If you understand what the fly is doing, and that goes back to what I said earlier, you know, if you're going to change something in a pattern, unless it's affecting the real thought behind, like John Paul put a lot of thought into that pattern. I mean, you wouldn't think so looking at it, you think, well, why didn't I think of that? We often think that when we look at flies, we think, well, why didn't I think of that? But there's a lot of thought gone into, because of hours on the water and perfecting it in his own mind. And I think, yeah, as long as you're not changing a material that has a fundamental effect on how it fishes, you know, go for it, change it, you know. And that's where the copper wire and the bead and the epoxy on the back, for me, all important to the sink rate, the profile, and the trigger points in the fly. And you can stick to those basics, but then change anything else. And and in any pattern, it goes without saying that is the case. I'm just trying to think while we're chatting off the top of my head what would be a fundamental part of a fly that you really shouldn't change, in my mind. Would probably be the underbody of a lake dragon is a perfect example. Some guys want to go and throw lead in there. Big mistake. It sinks like a brick. You want to use a wool as an underbody, you know. Or they might say, well, okay, what about using this flat Teflon sort of board? It gives you a flatter profile. That's going to affect the sink rate. I've seen it. So that's maybe a fundamental thing that you don't actually see in the fly, but it's something you shouldn't maybe play around with, is changing that underbody on a lake dragon. Don't use lead. Don't use hard materials such, you know, as this Teflon boards. And I've seen guys cutting manila file and all sorts of things. You know, don't do that. Use it. That's an example, I would say, probably. But nothing else in that fly needs to be conformed to exactly. He mixes seven colors of dubbing. And I know why he does. And if you look at a lake dragon with that blend of his, it looks 10 times better than plain olive rabbit dubbed, commercially tied. Nothing against the guys who put them together. I know they've got time constraints and they've got, you know, material costs and that, but and that's why you don't, you know, the commercial flies, I mean, R5.80 or R6 for a commercial fly. Anybody who complains about fly prices hasn't tied flies.
True.
And the guys who start out tying flies with me, they realize, geez, R6, R10, R15 for a fly. That's pretty reasonable. Yeah. So, yeah, you can change materials all the time, and I encourage it. I think it's a good thing to great stuff. Yeah.
Okay, so what do you enjoy tying?
What I really do enjoy doing is sitting down and tying my realistic flies and salmon flies, believe it or not. And why I really enjoy that is, and I think if I could mention, yeah, fly tires. And I always say this to guys, you know, you get into tying and there's a couple of levels of fly tying, just like there's a couple of levels of fly fishing, fly fishermen, is that you get into tying and you want to do it because it adds another aspect to your sport. You're happy with getting to a certain stage and you enjoy tying those flies that you're going to fish with, you're going to catch fish with, and you're happy. Those are the flies you used to buy and now you want to tie them yourself. Then you get the guys who, they're not happy with just that lot. They want to now experiment a little bit more. They're more interested in why these flies work, okay? Mm. Maybe if I change this and I do that, they become a little more creative and inventive, and they come up with their own patterns. And, you know, I don't ever say I designed a fly, because to sit down and say I designed a fly, you're treading on thin ice. Everything out there, let me tell you just about, has been designed. Every now and again somebody comes along with an idea that's, and usually it's an extension of something that exists, but they've changed it and perfected it. I've got to mention it, like Herman's Papa Roach, for me, is a classic example. That's such a deadly fly, and it's a very clever fly. He won that Fly of the Month and Fly of the Year with that fly, and he's taken some ideas and put them together into a really, really effective pattern. Then you get the level of the fly tie who fills up boxes, which I unfortunately don't get to do. I don't get the time to do that, and I admit it in to my mates and in my articles. And my fly boxes are terrible. They're not what they should be, and I'll say it again, because I just don't get, I'm not a repetitive tyer. I cannot stand sitting there and tying 10 of the same thing. You know, I just can't. Guys say, yeah, but Murray, why don't you tie 3 and then go to another one? I'm just not a repetitive tyer. And I'm working on it, and I've started another box, and I'll sit and do it, and I like to change and invent and do things. But then you get the level of tyer who's filled all his fly boxes. He's got his favorite flies, and I've seen some awesome fly boxes. I mean, they absolutely, they make your eyes water. And once you've done all that, you get the person who says, okay, I want to now start tying flies, expressing my fly tying in an art form, for argument's sake. And that, for me, is where I really enjoy my tying. It's not where I am, and you know, I'm not interested in the rest, of course not. I love to tie flies to catch fish, and I mean, that's why I do it. But I really enjoy the art aspect of fly tying and doing salmon flies. And I don't know if I'll ever get to throw at an Atlantic salmon. Hopefully I will. But I love to tie full-dress salmon flies, realistic flies, and put them in frames and mount them. And I give them away a lot to mates. That's why I don't have any in my house. You can go to my house. I don't have a dome with flies and all frame with a whole lot of realistic flies, because I give them away as gifts, and I get a big kick out of that, and the guys enjoy it. And so that's what I really enjoy.
Your knowledge of the fly tying industry is quite interesting, and I haven't heard people say that you got 500-800 tires in a room before. Just tell us a bit more about the fly tying industry.
I obviously follow it fairly closely. On an international level, there's some very big factories supplying Umpqua Feather Merchants is one. Fulling Mills in the UK. Those are probably two of the world leaders in fly tying circles. Now, Umpqua has factories in Sri Lanka and Thailand, and they've got huge numbers of tires. If you look into it, I stand to be corrected on full time, but I know that seasonal at any one time, some of those factories are sort of 200 to 300 tires involved. And you know, they're mostly women tires, and they tie exceptional flies. If you look at Fulling Mills, their factories are Kenya based, so they're not too far from where we are right now. And those factories in Kenya are, and the Umpqua ones, the quality control and the running of those factories and the stocking of raw material and the patterns, etc., all either American controlled and run, and or British UK run, but the actual labour is obviously the people there, and it works for both, because they are creating employment and jobs. They are on both sides of it, and in turn, these guys are getting. I don't want to call it. Yeah, it is probably to a degree. It is a cheap form of labour. It is, and that's how these fly tying factories work, because it's all piecework. Mm. You tie so many that make it to quality control, and through quality control you get paid for it. That's how we worked in Malawi, that's how they work in all these factories, is piecework. Mm. We were doing 57,000 dozen every 7 months with 70 tires, seasonal. Full-time we have, well, full-time and seasonal was about 110. So you can imagine how many flyers, sort of 300-400 fly tires are doing.
Okay, your favourite tires?
I really enjoy recently a guy by the name of Paul Woolock for the realistic tying. I think he's phenomenal. I think he's also an authentic realistic fly tie. Mm. He ties everything in. He doesn't glue or bake in oven or mold or anything like that, which some other well-known fly tyers supposedly do. I don't know about that. Don't bother with it. I just enjoy Paul Woolock. I like his book. He's come out with a really awesome book, his philosophy on tying. So that would be the realistic tying. I think my favorite tyer in the salmon scene is a guy named Mikhail Radencic. I've got a couple of his books. He's probably one of the best full-dress salmon fly tyers I've ever seen. Phenomenal fly tyer. Just on salmon flies, if anybody's got any interest, who wants to improve their fly tying tenfold, is play around with that fly tying. Do a little bit of this married wing stuff and mounting wings and salmon flies. And even if you just finish, stick it in a frame for yourself and that's it, you never do it again, it will improve your fly tying like you can't believe. Sure, there's so many. I really enjoy, from the deer hair point of view, one of my favorite tying techniques is spinning and stacking and packing deer hair. I really, really enjoy that. I would probably have to say Tim England. He's a phenomenal fly tie, great tie. Dave Whitlock, last one, another great fly tie, phenomenal fly tie. I think he's revolutionized fly tying in many areas, particularly on the deer hair scene, which is one of my favorite ways of tying as well. On the local scene, a fly tie that really needs mention is MC. If you've seen any of his flies, phenomenal flies. And another guy is Angelo Comas. You've got to see their boxes. I mean, I don't know if you've seen Angelo's boxes.
No, I haven't stuck my hand into his box yet.
You've got to see those fly boxes. And MC's, MC's won the world saltwater fly tying championships, the Scandinavian Open, 2 years running.
Sure.
Some guys don't know that. He puts his mind to tying a saltwater fly. He's a fantastic fly tying, one of the best in the country. And those are two local tires that I really enjoy. And if I can mention old Andrew, spinning deer hair. He's our Laxton's manager. He's a phenomenal fly tire as well. When it comes to deer hair work, he won't tell you that. He'll avoid the subject altogether. But,
yeah. you just mentioned Laxton's. I know you've just invested there and you're moving this shop.
Yeah, we're going to move. We've been here 9.5 years at the four-way shop here, Fly Fishers Unlimited. So we're moving across to the Cedar Square. It's literally a kilometre away from us. So we're making the move. It's a bit of a bigger shop. It's going to be a better store. And, yeah, it's time for a change. Nicer centre. And, we feel our clients who know where we are here will follow us and hopefully we'll pick up some new clients.
Okay, advice for beginning fly fishers?
Choose your venues carefully. Do a little bit of homework. You know, if you're going to have your first fly fishing experience, try and make the best of it. And I'm not talking about the half an hour trip down the road to one of the farms. Those serve a purpose. And yeah, I mean, they are an introduction. But do a little bit of homework on where you go. Make sure that you know that it's a reputable place. It's a place that you've been advised to go to or been recommended to go to. They have a good management policy. They stock well if it is a stock water. But if you're going to go to some of the closer venues, do a bit of homework on the venue. Do your homework on where you're going to go. You know, make your money work for you and money well spent.
Your thoughts on conservation?
I think a lot of the time we get a little bit too emotionally involved in conservation. And emotions, we can't help it. Amongst us fly fishermen, it's fine. You know, we can all shout and scream. But when we go and talk to the powers that be who actually make the decisions and we get emotional about it, I don't think it's going to get us very far. So look at fishing licenses. I mean, do you know, I mean, when I went to the show in 2000, I spoke to the guys at Trout Unlimited. And I mean, what they raise, 75 in those days, it was 2000, now going back here, eight odd years, 2000, they were raising then $75 million on licenses.
Holy
and God. Fines for people who didn't pay licenses alone. That was their income. And that money went straight back into, can you buy a license in a fishing shop today? You can't. You can't go to a fishing shop and buy a license. We can tell you that you have to have it by law, and we can tell you where to get it, but we don't sell it. And, you know, maybe I'm saying what I shouldn't say, but that money I don't believe is going straight back into our waters or into, never mind into stocking fish or looking after us as fly fishermen, but just looking after the waters.
Okay, so let's move on to the quick fire favorites. And I know it's tough asking a fly tie what his favorite fly is, but see if you can run your hand over that one.
You know what, I'd probably have to say one of my favorites, and I think it's because I've had so much good fishing on it, is a good old yellow humpy. Eh?
Favorite nymph?
Ruan's Dragon, I think, followed closely by the good old Papa Roach. Now, it's become one of my favorites over the last two years nearly. Yeah, I've caught some of my best fish on it.
Favorite rod?
My favorite rod's an LPS 8'6"3. I've had it for a long time.
Favorite venue?
Seychelles. Favorite venue. Been there a couple of times, love it.
Favorite species?
Look, I like anything that eats a fly, but I would probably say bonefish. The whole aspect of catching bonefish is everything that, for me, that fly fishing is made to be. Yeah.
Favorite technique?
I really enjoy throwing bass bugs up into structure. It's one of my favorite ways of fly fishing. If you can find some really good bass waters, with a surface fly, mind you.
Yeah. Gauge or the gizmo?
My catch and weigh net, eh? I mean, I love it.
Favorite movie?
I'd say my favorite movie, and it's something I've recently watched, would be River Wolf, followed closely by Running Down the Man. Eh? They're just brilliant movies. Eh? That Jim Clear series of just, I mean, they're just brilliant.
Favorite book?
Classic Salmon Flies, and that would have been by Bates Jr., John Bates.
Interesting sightings on a river?
We were fishing, it happened on the Vaal. We were fishing for yellows, and one of my mates, Lou, hooked a yellow. Hooked a fish, we didn't know what it was. Broke him off under the willows. He made another cast, set up again, cast out again, hooked what he thought was another fish, and as he started to bring it up, there was his flies that he had just lost, because there was three on the rig. And so he'd actually hooked his rig again. This fish stayed right under the willows there. So he landed the fish. It was a barbel, okay, but the chances of him having hooked the barbel in the first place on the fly, yes, it happens, and then having hooked his rig again, and he happened to hook the hook. It was hook to hook. He got the barbel right and nearly landed it and ended up breaking off anyway, but we got to see what it was. It was just such a funny sight. I've got another sighting, if I can mention it. I mean, fishing for bass, I hooked a willow on a river as well. It was the Breeder, piece of willow. Was pulling the willow across the top of the water to get it off the fly I was fishing, and a largemouth bass of serious proportions hammered the willow. That was another favorite sighting of mine on the river. I mean, I quickly then took the willow off, put it there, but needless to say, he didn't come up again. But it was a huge bass on the Breeder. I was fishing with MC and them, and that was a favorite sighting. And I suppose the last one would have been that classical brown trout rise I saw on the Blue River, coming up to really tiny textbook fishing, you know, where you see those really four or five browns eating little. You don't get to see it too often in our country, and that was really fun.
Get to see it too often.
Yeah, if you're lucky. Yeah, not at all. But
this is going to be a stupid question, because I think you've answered it two or three times tonight. All expenses paid is going to be Atlantic salmon, but where?
You know what? I'm actually going to. It's not going to be Atlantic salmon. Can I tell you? It's close, but. What it's going to be? No, it's not going to be. It's going to be steelhead, British Columbia.
Oh, thank you, Murray. You've taught us a lot of stuff.
Thanks a lot, Mark. Thanks for having me. It's been great chatting to you.
They say you know life is given, but I tell you now, saw within that river, you find yourself in the heart of heaven. Clothes off so long you could swim forever. One place to rest your grace, the silver sands lead the way. The water's golden stories told, free clouds, sapphire summer days. Fun way to spend your day, take yourself deep right away. Drive 6 hours and walk 5 days.